So today we learn from the New York Times that the FBI investigation into Russian collusion with the Trump campaign was codenamed Crossfire Hurricane.
This is the first thing I've learned about the FBI counterintelligence investigation that has outraged me.
It's such
a bad code name.
Okay, so with that in mind, what would better Rolling Stone lyrics have been for a code name for this investigation?
Operation Agent Orange.
Operation Beast of Burden.
Oh, I like that.
It's one of my favorites.
How about Operation Ruby Tuesday?
I can't believe nobody's mentioned Operation Sympathy for the Devil.
Well, there's no sympathy.
Paint it black.
God. I mean, they with all the world of Rolling Stones lyrics available to them, they went with that.
Yeah. I mean, there's also better lyrics within that song, like Spike Right Through My Head.
If there were
it's a gas, gas, gas.
If there were any reason to purge the entire FBI leadership that has emerged in the last 2 years, the name of this operation.
It's kind of like a dad joke, right? It's like the nerdiest people trying to be cool.
Yeah, and now it's news, part of history. Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the Crossfire Hurricane edition. I'm Shane Harris, reporter who nobody consulted when naming their counterintelligence investigation.
I think we need, like, to set up a PR investigation for naming operations.
Yeah.
Maybe they should just make it someone's full-time job. Like,
doesn't
that's
NSA
all
just like
you
have
do.
The best ones? Because like some like computer spits it out. But it used to be like, didn't it used to also like be like some 7-year-old woman in an office who she was like egotistical giraffe.
Have you ever seen the awesome Twitter feed Magical Realism Bot?
Yes.
So they could just use a bot.
Magical Realism Bot produces better operation names than all of this together. And throughout this episode, I'm just going to read occasional quotes from Magical Realism Bot, maybe to inspire the FBI to better name these things.
Yeah, get with it, guys.
I'm not sure you'll be able to tell it from this week's actual news. I'm here in the Jungle Studio with my good friends, Susan Hennessy Benwittis and Tamara Kaufman Benwittis. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
The gang's all here on a rainy Wednesday.
It is rainy. It's glum.
It's glum. We had quite a rainstorm on Monday.
It's the rainforest version of the Jungle Studio.
It's the rain. That's exactly right. It feels especially tropical. On the podcast this week, Israel kills dozens of protesters in Gaza as the U.S. opens a new embassy in Jerusalem. President Trump wants to save jobs at ZTE, the Chinese company that officials say threatens U.S. national security. And the government has a suspect in the leak of CIA hacking tools. Let's start with the, I guess it was two news stories really out of Israel. One, the opening, officially opening of the embassy in Jerusalem. And we've talked on the podcast before about the controversy and the debate around that move. But let's focus on these protests that erupted on the border with Israel and Gaza. There have obviously been protests there for some time, but they turned incredibly deadly this week with, I think, last count I saw was 52 people killed.
I think we may be up towards 60.
So that's the news, Tammy. But like, let's talk about just like, you know, how Israel approached this and what exactly happened here at the border. I think some people, myself included, were initially sort of shocked that what had been these protests that had been going on for some time suddenly turned so extraordinarily violent so quickly.
Okay, so the first thing is that once the Trump administration made a decision that for symbolic reasons they were going to open their embassy on this date, which is the Western calendar's anniversary of the founding of Israel, also the Palestinian Nakba, the anniversary of Palestinians' dispossession, it was inevitable that these two events were going to be linked in history. Palestinians, like Israelis, have been planning for this 70th anniversary for a long time. And in Gaza, what was initially 6 weeks of protests planned by a group of independent civic movements has been hijacked over the weeks by extremists, including by Hamas, which rules in Gaza. And when these protests actually started 6 weeks ago, there was one extremely violent day And then the protesters dialed it back and the Israelis dialed it back. But this week was the culmination, the 70th anniversary itself. And so it was inevitable that there would be those with an interest in provoking confrontation. And that is indeed what happened. We have actually some really excellent reporting, I think, from Western newspapers, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, who had people on both sides of the border. And, you know, I guess what I would say here is that it was because this confrontation was, in a sense, inevitable. The real question is not necessarily what happened on that day or why did things go down tactically the way they did. The more important question is, why wasn't the Israeli army better prepared for this day? Why hadn't Israeli intelligence been able to do more to disrupt those who were trying to use the protests for violent purposes to actually attack the fence between Gaza and Israel? Why wasn't the IDF able to develop more creative, non-lethal means of keeping people back from the fence? In other words, why did we end up in a situation where it was Israeli military snipers facing off against Palestinians with wire cutters?
So what do you think the answer to that is?
I mean, you know, in the broadest sense, there's been strategic warning about decline, you know, a deterioration of conditions in Gaza for a long time, for many months. There's unfinished business here dating back from the December 2014 war between Hamas and Israel. A lot of Gazan infrastructure remained unreconstructed. And the humanitarian situation has really gotten a lot worse. There's very little potable water. There's only a few hours of electricity a day. Schools and hospitals that haven't been rebuilt are overwhelmed and so on. So there's a lot of pressure that's been building there. And the IDF has been warning the Israeli political establishment of the need to address humanitarian conditions in Gaza. But I think largely for reasons of domestic politics, the Israeli defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, hasn't been interested in taking a magnanimous approach or taking a broader, more overarching approach toward resolving the problem of Gaza.
So, Tammy, can I ask sort of, you know, one thing that I was struck by was, you know, the image of the smiling Jared and Ivanka, you know, unveiling the embassy. You know, I'm curious, based on sort of your State Department background, what should we expect a normal, highly sensitive rollout of something like this to look like? So one thing that I was struck by was this is Jared and Ivanka speaking for the United States on an unbelievably sensitive issue in which the words really, really matter. And in the context of this flashpoint, this violence that is going on, it seems so incredibly sensitive. Am I just, you know, anti all things Jared and Ivanka and no, you know, oftentimes we sort of put a, you know, whatever admin official face on that kind of thing? Or is this something that we would ordinarily expect a very, very high level official to be shepherding? Sort of how unusual is that element of it?
Yeah, so look, usually embassy openings are not that controversial. Obviously, this is an exception. I think actually the words that Jared included in his remarks, and he was the one who spoke at the event, were fine in the sense that they declared administration policy that, you know, Jerusalem is Israel's capital and that the administration doesn't believe that that precludes a peace deal, that it doesn't prejudge the negotiations over the status of Jerusalem that both sides have agreed to, and that the administration still hopes for peace. So formally, he said what you would want to say. I think it's more about the context. If you were dealing with a controversial and sensitive issue like this thoughtfully, you would want to design an event that is as inclusive as possible, both to ameliorate hurt feelings over the decision, but also to implicate as wide as possible of a political spectrum in the event itself. So that means you would have everybody across the Israeli political spectrum. You might invite, for example, Ayman Odeh, the head of the Joint Arab List in the Israeli parliament. I think he was, in fact, invited, but chose not to attend. But you would also invite a range of Democratic members of Congress. You would invite former ambassadors to Israel from Democratic and Republican administrations. They did none of that. They actually, the invites, the speaking roles were as narrow politically as you can possibly imagine.
Including the anti-Semitic pastor.
And Islamophobic pastor, like all rolled into one.
At least it's inclusive in that sense.
So it was almost designed to alienate.
Both of you.
And Mormons. In other words. He really doesn't like Mormons. Pit of hell was his description.
It was notable that the first tweet about his presence at this event was from Mitt Romney. Yeah.
So look, I mean, I think it's important to separate to the extent that we can the embassy opening problem from the Gaza problem. They're connected, of course, but they're also different. And with the Gaza issue, I think we should start with the understanding that this is a huge win for Hamas that Bibi Netanyahu handed them. Hamas announced that they wanted to get as many people killed as possible and get it blamed on Israel. And they got a lot of people killed. They got even more people injured, and they got it all blamed on Israel. And so you got to put yourself in the minds of in the strategic mind of the terrorist organization and say, what were they trying to do? They told you what they were trying to do, and they got it done. And now, if you're an Israeli policymaker or military strategist, and you're saying, how can we deny Hamas what they're trying to get? You should be ashamed of yourself, because you gave them exactly what they publicly announced that they wanted. I think there's two elements of that. One of them, both of which Tamara just talked about, but I want to flag them separately. One is the short-term tactical question of how do you deal with large numbers of people storming a wall, a border that you have every right to defend. The second question, and by the way, I don't know what the answer to that is. I think it's probably tactically a very hard question, but if the answer is you have to kill a lot of people, and so the terrorist group gets exactly what it publicly said it wanted, you're doing it wrong. I don't know what the right answer is, but I know that's the wrong answer.
Well, and they've had months to think about whether they could come up with some creative solutions to that problem.
The second question, the much harder question, I think, is how do you address the general humanitarian conditions in Gaza in a fashion that does not empower the leadership of Hamas? And that is an extraordinarily difficult question. It's one that a lot of people who are, whose blood is boiling this week, rightly so, don't really care to face the difficulty of. But I think it is one that Israel needs to think very, very hard about, and the United States needs to think very hard about, because the alternative is the effective misery, the perpetuation of misery of 2 million people who aren't going anywhere. And you're either going to figure out a better way for them to exist politically and materially, or you're going to have a powder keg, which is what this week showed. And again, that is an extraordinarily difficult long-term question. But if you're not thinking about that question, you're just asking for the next time something like this is going to happen, probably with more substantial weapons than wire cutters.
Yeah, so I think your point about kind of tactical success, strategic failure is exactly right. And the broader strategic failure here is the one that it's kind of blown me away, actually, that Benjamin Netanyahu, in nearly 10 years as prime minister, has managed to get away without offering his own citizens a solution to this dilemma, which is that the Gaza Strip, you know, right next to a bunch of Israeli villages, is run by a really hostile entity that, when it feels it's in its political interest or when its population is miserable enough to put pressure on it, shoots a whole lot of rockets at Israeli civilians. And, you know, Netanyahu himself has presided over repeated rounds of violence as a result of this unresolved dilemma. And somehow his own voters have not held him accountable for not coming up with a solution to this problem. A solution to this problem, of course, would involve some diplomatic engagement with the Palestinian Authority, if not with Hamas itself. And for Netanyahu, this seems to be just a bridge too far.
So just one last question, just to wrap this point up. If the United States had opened the embassy on a different day than this particular day, this Independence Day, and this day that is marked as a day of sorrow and outrage by the Palestinians, would the events have still occurred? I mean, would they have been this disastrous on any day that the United States opened that embassy?
You would not have had the culmination of 6 weeks of the Great March of Return in Gaza coinciding with the embassy opening, but there almost certainly would have been some level of protest. We've seen a lot of protests erupt around Jerusalem itself, including on what seemed like very minor issues like the installation of metal detectors to access the Temple Mount, which sparked off major protests a couple years ago. So this is Jerusalem. Every inch, every tiny decision has symbolic import in this identity conflict. And so I think you would have seen something. And, you know, the Trump administration could have made this decision in a context of some broader strategy toward Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking, some new American engagement. And that also would have ameliorated the effects. But they chose to do it in a way that's entirely divorced from policy considerations.
Nakba Day is a very big deal to Palestinians. And Israeli Independence Day is a very big deal to Israelis. It's a much bigger deal than 4th of July is to the United States. And so when you choose to do something like this on a day that is enormously important culturally and in identity terms to both sides, you're playing with fire.
But, you know, Netanyahu could also have said, hey, gosh, Donald, that's a great idea, but maybe not.
Right. There's a lot. And of course, Hamas could have made a decision not to throw large numbers of people up against, live fire that they knew was coming. You know, so everybody has a lot of opportunities not to behave in the way that gets a lot of people killed.
So speaking of decisions that are divorced from the larger policy reality.
Ooh, that is a tough segue.
You're getting good at this, Shane. You're tying it all together.
But it's true.
Nice
you
bow.
Teed it up perfectly.
I just want to, before we continue that, I just want to point out that Magical Realism Bot says an Australian pharmacist has a rhinoceros instead of a mustache. And I think rhinoceros mustache would be an excellent name code name for an operation.
Sure, much more discreet, that's for sure. So President Trump wants to reverse, it sounds like, U.S. policy towards the Chinese telecommunications company ZTE, which many, many current and former intelligence officials have warned poses a threat to the United States because it could effectively be an arm of massive surveillance by the Chinese government. President Trump says he wants to save jobs at ZTE, says, we've gone too far on previous policies.
Make China great again.
Susan, I want to kick this to you because this is very much in the wheelhouse that you occupy, and I imagine probably many, many people at the place where you used to work on that long commute out the VW Parkway are pulling their hair out to hear that the president, putting aside the political aspects of the make China great again, why are you saving Chinese jobs? This runs just so completely counter to everything that top national security officials have said, which is that this company legitimately poses a threat insofar as its equipment being installed in the United States or in places where we have interests.
Yeah, so there are a lot of different threads about why this is such a bad idea and sort of what's going on. You know, the first context to understand here is that ZTE is a very, very bad actor, and we have accused them of being very, very bad actors. We've actually taken unusual steps to offer evidence of why we believe that they are violating sanctions, not just by selling to Iran, not just by selling to North Korea, not just by selling to Sudan, but essentially they sell to every sanctioned nation. They've also been accused of lying to U.S. investigators in really serious ways. And so what Trump is effectively advocating for is both a lift of a 7-year ban that the Commerce Department had imposed and also this $1 billion fine. So it really has sort of economically crippled this company. You know, look, there's a big sort of China policy and potentially corruption question, which is Trump appears to have sort of bypassed all of his trade officials. And so who got Trump's ear on this particular issue and how is that direct line? And
she got Trump's ear on this particular issue.
Sure, potentially. Or, you know, was it somebody with big, there's a lot of money at stake here. And so I think there's a lot of questions about how exactly did Trump decide to tweet this? You know, there's the question about whether or not this was a give. He's being played on North Korea negotiations. Like this was a gesture of goodwill to China in advance of sort of the North Korea stuff. This is a huge win for China. And so if Trump is thinking that he's some kind of savvy actor in the North Korea deal, I think it starts to show the ways in which he might be getting played 6 ways to Sunday without even realizing it. And that all sort of culminates in the national security issue and the reason why really heads are exploding, you know, at places like Fort Meade. And that's that, you know, ZTE manufactures parts for mobile phones. They mostly don't sell them in the United States. They do a little bit, but that's not really the concern. ZTE is one of the two Chinese companies that manufactures equipment that is critical to cellular networks and cellular networks that are used around the world, including outside the United States. So the implications of that are twofold. One, China has been trying to offer alternatives to United States technology equipment around the world for a long time, partly as a way to reduce U.S. intelligence capabilities to the extent that the U.S.
and expand their own.
Right, so the goal, you know, cuts both ways, right? They're trying to make it harder for the United States, which currently has, you know, sort of a global monopoly on the equipment. So that allows them both to defend the supply chain and also potentially exploit the supply chain to the extent that they do that. It also offers China an opportunity to use that equipment in such a way as to collect intelligence, including intelligence that might be used against the United States. So this is really high stakes stuff. This is big, big policy with very, very broad implications. And so, you know, it's bringing together all the areas in which Trump is an especially bad president on national security issues. And it's not clear whether or not it's, you know, something going on here that's there's a corrupt purpose or he's getting played, you know, or does he just not understand what's happening?
So Susan and I have been writing a book about the Trump presidency and the norms, the historical norms that he is doing violence to. And the chapter that I'm currently working on involves the development of executive branch process. And this is a really interesting example of the absence of executive branch process, right? Where, so you have a whole lot of agencies that have spent a lot of time developing information and policy towards ZTE. And then the president talks to Xi, and she gives him a list of, hey, could you do this? Could you do this? And the president just tweets something with no reference to this very substantial policy process that has developed an approach to thinking about the problem that ZTE presents. And I think it's quite apart from the merits of the issue, on which I certainly agree with Susan, it is a remarkable picture in a single tweet of the relationship between President Trump and the idea of executive branch process, which is that, you know, things that other presidents would have bubbled up from presidential policy, would have bubbled up from the concerns of the Commerce Department and the NSA and, you know, all the different agencies that have equities in this. In his case, the presidency is just a personal thing. It's him, she, and a Twitter feed. And, you know, I don't know what to make of that, except that there's, you know, there's something very profound in there.
Yeah, so I think we've seen him take a similar approach to other policy issues and announce things by tweet that he's been convinced of by some individual, regardless of whatever internal deliberations may be taking place in the executive branch. But I think what's interesting about this case is that he said this. He said, you know, it's about Chinese jobs and I've instructed the Commerce Department to do it ASAP. Wilbur Ross then sort of jumps, you know, Trump says jump and he says how high and tells everybody, okay, we're going to deal with this issue separately from all the other trade stuff we're talking about with China. And then Trump comes back and says, oh, no. This is part of this bigger trade talk. And is that him walking back because he looks bad, or is that Ross just totally not understanding the president's intent because actually he has no clue?
Or both,
right? And so I think it adds to your notion that it's really, really revealing about something that is unique in the way the Trump administration does business. But I guess my question about that is, what if it's not that the president's being played by Xi and giving away too many concessions for the sake of a North Korea summit? Maybe what's going on here is that Trump actually thinks his personal relationship with Xi is more important than North Korea. It's more important than the specifics of the trade deal, because what really matters is that he likes other people. They treat him well and they like him. And so, you know, all of these things are just tools to be manipulated for the sake of that broader end.
So I think that's right. I think the way to put that, though, is that Donald Trump cares more about his personal relationship with Xi than about the national security interests of the United States of America.
Or that he can't tell the difference between the two.
Or he doesn't care to. It doesn't matter to him.
Or that he thinks through his personal relationship he can best protect the national security interests.
But he really does believe l'état c'est moi. So if my relationship with Xi is good, then whatever the U.S. needs, I can get.
But then he's just a fool, right? So sure, maybe that's his okay. Right. But if he really is convinced
really feels,
that China is our friend, and oh, you know, well, we're gonna let them take over, you know, all African cell phone networks. But you know, they're gonna play by the rules, guys. They'll be cool about this. Don't worry. Well, I don't know how to respond to that on other than to say, well, then you're an idiot if you think that, because that's not what's gonna happen. And so, you know, whether or not, whatever the motivation is, I think this is another example of decisions and impulses that have long-term consequences. This is not the kind of stuff that the next president comes in and says, all right, let's roll all this stuff back. These are the tools of American power and the way we use this sort of soft power around the world to preserve our dominance, presumably for the purpose of making the world safer for people and ideas, which is what we're all supposed to be doing here. You know, these are the kinds of decisions. They seem technical, some Chinese company that nobody's heard of and it doesn't matter, that actually has really, really significant consequences. And he does it again and again, and he doesn't appear to be paying any kind of a political price. You know, we might have seen Wilbur Ross jump, but we didn't see Congress coming down like a ton of bricks. We didn't see, you know, the intel agencies being really clear and public. And so, you know, I think it's an open question. What is going to happen? And we shouldn't be in that position. We should understand what precisely the administration's policies is with respect to these companies, and our allies should understand it, and our adversaries should understand it.
And Magical Realism Bot tweets, on New Year's Eve, a message is inscribed on an obsidian disc. It reads, be kind to secretaries. And I just want to say Operation Obsidian Disc would have been way better.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, actually.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of discs.
That was
I want to see where you go with this one.
Things that like might be secret that you might put on a disc and remove from the CIA and get WikiLeaks.
Very good.
Okay. That's so 20th century. A disc?
It's good.
So many of our listeners don't know what a floppy disc is.
Go see War Games. Which, by the way, I rewatched last week.
It's good.
Totally holds up.
Yeah. Really?
It really does.
And by the way, that is one of the most consequential movies in U.S. history because Ronald Reagan watched it and scratched his head and said, could this happen? And that had important implications in the history of cybersecurity.
There you go.
It's a great story. You should read Fred Kaplan's book, Dark Territory,
where he recounts this.
So local reporter broke a story this week about,
Could you quit breaking so damn much news? I mean,
go to bed, take a freaking vacation,
read a Dilbert and go to sleep. That's an illusion. See if anybody gets that. Tweet us if you got that illusion. Anyway. So the CIA, last year, a huge arsenal of CIA cyber weapons, if you like, but really we're talking about things like exploit code. Ended up on WikiLeaks under the label that WikiLeaks gave it Vault 7, which
is a decent code name.
That's actually pretty good. Not as good as Obsidian Disk.
What the FBI pulled off.
Pretty good. Which was as a reference to the essentially the server or the place, if you like, from which the information was swiped in the first place. So there is a suspect in the case, a guy named Josh Adam Schulte, who worked for this group at the CIA that actually built the tools. What's interesting about his case is that he is currently being held in the Manhattan Correctional Center, a jail in New York City, not on charges of stealing information, but on child pornography charges. The feds raided his house last year, took a bunch of computers and equipment. I will note, did not then charge him with the child pornography case for another several months. During which time they were eyeing him as the suspect in this leak investigation and in the Vault 7 case, and they have also acknowledged in open court that, in fact, he is the target and the investigation is ongoing. So, Susan, maybe I'll kick this to you, too, since this is kind of, again, in your wheelhouse, but it struck me as notable but perhaps not all that unusual that this person whose apartment is raided, his equipment is taken, clearly the feds believe he may have been the person who leaked this information. Some months go by, they can't make the case, and then he's charged with something else. And that, by the way, those charges and that potential trial are proceeding quite slowly for a number of reasons that we don't have time to get into. But that struck me as not all that unusual, possibly a tell that what they were trying to do was sort of keep him in the box and sweat him out on these Vault 7 charges, and that the child pornography trial charges, while quite serious if he's in fact guilty of them, are in service of getting him to cooperate or plead on the espionage charge.
Yeah, so look, there's a lot of strange things that is going on in this case. In the course of conducting an investigation and going over lots and lots of electronic evidence, it is not unusual that investigators run across evidence of other crimes. And actually, this is not common, but also not uncommon way by which child pornography is discovered. And so the notion that if the government found that they would then prosecute it, that's not unusual. It's also not wrong. We shouldn't think about that as like, oh, this is a pretext. You know, these are trumped up charges on child pornography, but really they want them on this other thing. It's entirely possible that the government really, really believes that this person was involved in the dissemination of child pornography and so those are serious allegations that they want to proceed upon in their own regard. Now, there are some questions, and we're dealing with some incomplete transcripts here. There are kind of questions about how strong the government's case is on the child pornography issues, including whether or not he had total control of the server and how many people had access to the server. So they're a long way from sort of making their case, but they don't have to make their case yet because they've just charged him, and whether or not that'll go to trial is later. Yeah, but there is a lot here that I do think looks like the government sort of trying to slow things down. One of the strange things that happened is they actually let him out on bail and then really pushed to revoke his bail condition or the conditions of his release on some, you know, a little bit of a thin argument. Or you wouldn't ordinarily expect the government to be that aggressive.
Yeah, they claimed that he was using computers in his apartment in violation of his home confinement agreement when his roommate was the one using the computers. And they can prove that, they say.
Right. And what this all gets at is whether or not the government has evidence that was derived from some kind of source that they don't want to put in on the record yet. You know, there is SEPA. There is the ability to enter classified information in a way that's protected. But that's a hard interagency fight. It's a hard fight between DOJ and the Intel agencies. And so I think the thing that people are suspicious of, although, you know, we don't know what's going on from the record, is, look, the IC has some reason or evidence to believe that this guy is the source of the leak. They potentially have some reason to believe either that he is an ongoing threat, that he's going to, that he's going to try and flee the jurisdiction, something like that. And they are not, for whatever reason, they are not making that case directly to the court because they don't want to put classified information on the record. And instead, they're doing this other thing. I think these are reasonable questions to be asking.
So this leak happened about a year ago, right? And they've had this guy in jail for a few months. I mean, that's pretty quick, isn't it, to have identified somebody as the likely source of a leak of this magnitude?
It's interesting. He would have just left the agency by the time that the leaks happened. So it was not long, though, after the leaks occurred that they focus in on him. So, yeah, I mean, it does suggest that there was there was both, I think, circumstantial evidence insofar as he tells it was the only member of that group to have recently left the agency, was known to be a disgruntled employee. He didn't filed internal complaints about management at the group, and he
because they wouldn't let him keep child porn on his CIA computer.
That was not the stated reason. And he was actually planning a trip out of the country, he says, with his brother for spring break to Cancun. So you put all those pieces together. But I think to Susan's point too, you know, that's circumstantial evidence, but the speed of it also suggests, and we have not seen this evidence, that there could be some kind of forensic information with this as well. One thing that is odd to me is that in reporting on the leaks when they happened a year ago, all of my reporting was showing that the suspicion was falling on a contractor or contractors and not on a CIA employee, which is what Josh Schulte was. And there was one going theory that this was a disgruntled contractor who didn't get their contract renewed and leaked this information in retaliation. It struck the people who were my sources on that as strange. It's like, oh, well, this isn't what we thought it was, actually.
And one query on that, is it because the government is so entrenched in how they view the insider threat as actually an outsider insider threat that they just assumed that that had to be what was going on and missed whatever was going on right in front of them, right under their own nose?
So in terms of like the deterrent interest of the government here, is it enough to have publicly fingered this guy and to have identified him so quickly after the event? Or do they really need to be able to put him on trial and get a conviction in order to have deterrent impact?
Well, they didn't plan for it to become public, but go ahead,
yeah,
Ben.
So first of all, if you're going to have somebody who, you know, is basically Al Capone and you're going to get him for tax evasion, child porn is a freaking great statute to have to hang over somebody. So as Quinta Jurassic and I discovered, and a lot of listeners know, when we were doing our research on sextortion, these statutes are an astonishingly powerful club. They have a ferocious mandatory minimum. The elements of them are relatively easy to prove. And if you were, you know, hosting or distributing or hoarding a whole lot of child porn, and the government gets a hold of you, they're going to be able to put you in jail for a lot of years. And it is much easier to prove, and you don't have to declassify anything, than, you know, leaks of major CIA source code. So
if I'm a disgruntled CIA employee who's sympathetic to the ideology of WikiLeaks,
don't
I can
do child porn.
Yeah, I can just say, well, I'm not going to collect child porn, and then I'll be fine.
Yeah, well, let me flip it around. You are making the government's job against you a lot easier if, in addition to whatever you are giving to WikiLeaks, you are also hoarding child porn. And so in this case, I think, you know, this guy may have done the CIA an enormous favor if they can't produce this. But there's one thing that a child porn case can't get unless, you know, unless they can cut a deal, which is his cooperation. And the first thing that an agency wants in a situation like this, and this is true in all spying cases and all, is a rigorous damage assessment. And they want to know what happened, what's the part of the story they don't know. And unless they can cut a deal with him, either on the child porn stuff or on the other stuff, they don't actually get to do that. And so I think whether or not the government can, assuming the government can prove the child porn case, and by the way, I've never seen a child porn case that's gotten dropped ever. Assuming they can prove those, they have a lot of leverage here, but they want something from this guy, and it's something very important to them.
One thing that does go to this point is understanding the precise nature of this leak and why it was so damaging, and that it's part and parcel of some other things that we're seeing. The Snowden disclosures disclosed a lot about capabilities, and it had really tremendous, astounding impacts on the ability of the United States to collect intelligence. But it was an indirect effect. The materials that were released as part of Vault 7, you know, which is similar to the Shadow Brokers leak, is the direct exploit information, right? It's not just what the United States is doing. It is precisely how it's being done. And so once those tools are out, they are shattered. The cat is out of the bag. And they aren't just shattered for the U.S.'s capability. They also now create a massive vulnerability, because a lot of these were in systems that actually exist within the United States. And so this is a form of leak that is especially damaging and pernicious.
Just one last question briefly, and Ben, this to you. So Schulte's defense in this, as we understand it from transcripts, and I know from my own reporting, is that this server on which the child pornography was found was one that he built with friends more than 10 years ago, and somewhere between, in his guess, 50 to 100 people had access to. So presuming that's true, is in a case like this, with the forensic tools that are available to investigators, can you prove beyond a reasonable doubt that in a situation where a server that is open to many dozens of people, all of whom could have uploaded and downloaded information on that, can you fairly easily or readily prove that it was this one individual that was doing it? Or do you need other evidence to bolster that?
So I don't know the forensics well enough to answer that question. I do know that, and I'd be interested in Quinta's sense of this, though she doesn't have a microphone in front of her face, but we looked at 80 sextortion cases, 80 plus, many of which had a child pornography element. There is not one of those cases that turns on a forensic difficulty in showing, once the government has alleged that these suspects had child pornography on their computers, that it was theirs or that they're responsible for it. And so, now to the extent that this is a proxy for something else, and therefore they may have gone with a weak case, this may be different from the cases that we've looked at, but we didn't look at a single case that even went to trial because people were so because the government's ability to prove these cases is so overwhelming.
That somebody just pleaded guilty.
People just plead out.
Which has not happened for many, many months.
Right. I mean, look, the other thing that's worth knowing is everyone who's ever been indicted in the history of the U.S. code, it's been not their child pornography or child exploitation materials. This is kind of the go-to thing. The government has submitted at least one evidence of a chat transcript in which he and another individual explicitly reference this server being used for child pornography. Now, there's a way to possibly read that as it being part of sort of a dark joke, but considering the fact that it actually ends up materializing, it has pretty dramatically undercut the "I had no idea that this stuff was going on" case.
Yeah. Here's a pro tip. Don't even joke about child porn.
Don't even joke.
Don't joke. Not funny.
Magical Realism Bot tweets, 50 doctoral students live together inside a golden swamp.
Oh.
Operation
Golden,
Golden Swamp.
That's what they should have called it.
It's hard to argue with Operation Golden Swamp.
It's right in the face. What? All right, before we move on to object lessons, we had so much fun with this last week, which we did at the top of the show, but this week, the stories that we're not talking about because we only have room for three. So quickly, and we'll do rapid fire reactions. North Korea might cancel the summit with President Trump.
Duh.
Duh. Okay. Iraq had parliamentary elections and Muqtada al-Sadr won.
Yay!
Duh.
Go Muqtada.
Well, can I just say, I love that when this guy first emerged, all of our newspapers were saying that he's like a schizophrenic, he's completely insane, and now he's going to be our favorite Iraqi politician.
Wow. Times have changed. The DHS secretary didn't resign after a screaming match with President Trump. Wasn't really screaming match.
And Trump just while we were sitting here, Trump said that she was doing a great, very hard job.
Yeah,
that's all you need.
She'll
tweet
be fired
from
at the
boss.
Next boardroom meeting. The Trump administration wants to separate families who cross the border illegally and house the kids on military bases.
You people suck so badly.
And the Senate Judiciary Committee releases transcripts of their interview with participants in the infamous Trump Tower meeting about dirt on Hillary Clinton.
I don't recall
anything about that.
I spent 3 hours of my precious life this morning reading only half of the Don Jr. transcript, in which he seems to not recall very much about anything.
Don Jr. doesn't know nothing about nobody.
It worked for Ronald Reagan.
Buddy. Sure. Well, I mean, in a manner of speaking. All right, now let's move on to object lessons. I will go first. So I'm reading a wonderful new book, which is not a long book, and I think that listeners of the podcast will really like it. It is Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics by Stephen Greenblatt.
Ooh.
Stephen Greenblatt, who's written a terrific history before of Shakespeare called Will and the World. Others may know him as the author of The Swerve.
Great book.
Which really is one of the great nonfiction books of recent memory. It's fantastic. But Greenblatt clearly provoked not just by his love and authority when it comes to Shakespeare, but by the present moment that we're in, to look at all of the Shakespeare plays and look to them for Shakespeare's meditation on the nature of tyrants and how they come to power and how they are treated. And what makes it an especially interesting and fun read is that in Shakespeare's time, I actually did not know this, but it was illegal, it was punishable by death to call the king or the queen or the sovereign a tyrant. And you could not stage plays about the present moment. You couldn't do a play about Queen Elizabeth. So Greenblatt's idea here is that Shakespeare has to go back and reach into distant history and sometimes even ancient history to comment on the present moment. And there was this great fear and anxiety in England at the time that Queen Elizabeth, who was nearing the end of her life and had no heirs, would this give way to tyranny in England? And so it's interesting to see how Greenblatt kind of takes you back through the text and says, how can we read this not just for what was going on in England at the time, but then the lessons about tyrants. And he does not shy away from drawing allusions to the present moment, which makes it especially delicious. And he's such a great writer and so entertaining. So check it out.
There are countries now where you cannot call the monarch a tyrant. In fact, in Morocco, a magazine published a poll demonstrating how incredibly popular the king was, and they were not allowed to do that. So,
wow. All right, so check it out, Stephen Greenblatt. He's back.
I have an object lesson as well. I'm in our noble tradition of log rolling on rational security. I have launched a new project here at the Brookings Institution. It is a Sourced List. It is a database of women in technology policy and a resource for journalists and event planners and other people who want to talk to somebody who's not a dude. We promise that they actually are out there, and we have made them incredibly easy for you to find. So if you know women who are experts in technology policy, we're defining that very, very broadly. Please send them the link to sign up. If you are an event planner or a journalist and you want to talk to some new and more diverse sources, use it. It is sourcelist.org. And we are pretty happy to see it out in the world at long last.
So stop complaining and start a revolution. And that's
exactly
what Susan did.
Don't tell me you can't find women that's anymore.
Right. And journalists, you've been warned. Check it out. Go. Right. Expand your horizons.
There you go. All right, so this is not log rolling, but this is a bit of a celebration. Our fantastic producer, Jen Patia Howell, the best ever, the best producer we've ever had.
She cleans this up
in
so
the
nice
history
every week.
Of rational security, number one.
But we love Jen, and we are thrilled to send our congratulations out to Jen as she takes on a new role as co-executive director of a new organization called Virginia Civics. Virginia Civics is the sponsor of a wonderful civic education program that's been around in the state of Virginia for a number of years now called We the People, the Citizen and the Constitution Program. So as we sit here on this show and frequently decry the lamentable state of civic education in the U.S., how unprepared our citizens are to assess what their president is doing, how the rule of law fits in, what's the role of the separate branches of government. Here is a big shout out to Virginia Civics and to Jen and her colleagues for giving a permanent institutional home to this really important project. And congratulations.
Go, Jen.
So I met Jen a number of years ago now when Brookings and Montpelier, which is the home of James, the historic home of James Madison, where Jen used to work and used to be the home of this program, Brookings and Montpelier got together to do some programming together, which we did for 5 years, and that's actually how I first met Jen. And what was Spaghetti on the Wall Productions and Rational Security's original producer kind of grew originally out of that relationship. And so it's really cool that Jen is retaining this civic education portfolio in this new form.
And she's still going to keep us in line every week.
Yeah, at least we hope so. Because we need it. We need it bad, Jen.
Please don't get too busy.
And I don't have an object lesson, but Magical Realism Bot tweets, a fellowship of zombies are going on a quest. Their aim is to do battle with a gigantic swarm of bees. I think Operation Zombie Fellowship, particularly for Shane's husband, Joe, is really a good name.
That would be his fave.
It would be his fave.
He would be a member of a zombie fellowship if he could, or he at least would paint them. That brings us to the end of the podcast. Rational Security is a production of Lawfare. You can find our show page in some fellowship of zombies on the internet someplace.
Yeah, we're eventually going to move it from the Spaghetti on the Wall site, which
dead
is
page.
Dead, but...
There's a much like a
zombie website out there.
Fellowship of zombie websites.
You can find us on Twitter at RATL Security. You can find us on Facebook. Whenever you download the podcast, please be sure to leave us a rating and review. It really helps us out. And we love reading them. Thank you very much. Your comments are both inspiring and constructive, except when they're not. No, they usually are.
We love you all and all your comments.
No, they're great. They're really great. We appreciate it. The show is produced and edited, of course, by Jen Patia Howell, our audio engineer this week. Thank you, Quinta Jurassic, stepping back into the booth, such that it is. It's not really a booth, but, nothing's what it seems in the jungle studio. Music performed this week by Donald Trump, and that's what she said.
What?
That was like, damn, this is a tough room. Haven't we used that joke before? That's what
yes,
she said.
But what is it in reference to?
That's such
to?
A middle school joke.
The CTE thing.
Oh, that's what she said. I see what you did. All right. You know, if you have to explain it, then it doesn't work.
If you had it spelled out here, I mean, maybe if I put like a little more she or something like that, I don't know, on it, like a little spin on it.
Then we would have gotten it.
You guys loved it, even though you didn't know you did. It's like a joke grenade. If there were a band that Sophia Yan were fronting, it might be called That's What She Said.
By the way, everyone should watch Sophia Yan's Facebook video, which she did entirely from her iPhone, about the Big Island lava flows and the social impacts on people in the Big Island, where Sophia is now working as an AP reporter. Yeah. It's a pretty cool video, and you should all check it out.
Check it. On behalf of my good friends Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, Ben Wittes, and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. We'll talk to you next week. Obsidian Disc forever.